This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, our last show caught the attention of many of our listeners as those recommendations by the United States Preventative Services Task Force on breast cancer screening kicked off a national debate.
Mark, you're right. And we heard from one listener from Boston who wrote, "Your program was the best and most balanced coverage of the breast cancer guideline issue I've heard so far. Congratulations." The fact that a man and a woman were discussing breast cancer together was not lost on me or others, I'm sure. We need more conversations like this around health, healthcare, and health reform beyond health insurance reform. And he went on to say, "Mark's point on black women and breast cancer really struck home personally and professionally for me. Check out www.pinkandblack.org to learn about a Boston initiative that could be replicated in communities nationwide." And he said, "I wear their lapel pin with pride." Thanks for writing to us.
That's great. Conversations on Healthcare looks forward to continuing the dialogue as we focus in on issues of reform and innovation in the healthcare system. Speaking of healthcare reform, there was lots of activity in the United States Senate this week as the healthcare debate officially got underway this Monday. If the opening day is any indication of what's to come, there'll be lots of heat before we see any light.
Well, Mark, Senator Reid believes we will be seeing the light and we'll see it close to Christmas. He plans to have the Senate working nights and weekends so they can get a bill passed. Then it goes to the House Senate Conference Committee, then back to both chambers for that final vote.
The drama continues to unfold, and the country is getting a great civics lesson, as well as a doctorate-level understanding of the complexity of the healthcare system.
And speaking of doctors, today's featured guest is one of the country's leading innovators in primary care, Dr. Tom Bodenheimer. Dr. Bodenheimer is a renowned author, physician, and researcher who'll be talking with us about ways to improve costs, improve quality, and improve access in primary care.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. Download the podcast or get transcripts of our show, and we have some interesting links on the folks we interview.
And if you have feedback, email us at conversations@chc1.com. We love to hear from you. Last week, we gave our listeners fair warning, get ready for our pledge drive, and bring an open and generous heart as well as your checkbook. Because for the next 2 weeks, our station's doing its pledge drive, and we hope to raise $20,000 by the time the drive ends on December 13th.
WESU, which hosts this show, is a college radio station based on the campus of Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, and our thanks to WESU as they've been so supportive of our efforts. Margaret, you did a lot of cooking over Thanksgiving weekend. I know last week you wondered aloud what type of appeal could pull you away from the aroma of all that good food and contribute to community radio. What did you cook up for us?
Well, first I want to say I did cook a great Thanksgiving dinner. And it's a pretty straightforward appeal we're making, and it's as American as apple pie. Helping out your community radio station, it's good for your health, and we guarantee you will feel better right away.
I feel better already, but I do worry there are fewer opportunities to hear the voice of the people as big companies take over radio markets all around the country and even here in our listening area. That's why WESU is so important. It's radio content grown locally, and we couldn't do it without the students and community volunteers who donate their time every week to produce alternative music and talk shows not heard anywhere else.
But most importantly, your contribution matters. Support WESU now by calling 860-685-7700 or log on to WESUFM.org to make your donation to our third annual holiday pledge drive.
Just in case you lost track of time, the holiday season is upon us, and many of you will be buying gifts for your family and friends and those you care about. How about giving WESU-FM Community Radio a gift? Your donations will help us continue to bring you wonderful community radio programs. Give us a call at 860-685-7700 or log on to WESUFM.org to make your donations to our annual pledge drive. And we also are offering some specials. A $25 donation will get you a brand new WESU t-shirt. A $30 donation will get you a WESU long sleeve shirt, and a $50 donation will get you a WESU hooded sweatshirt.
And I know my nephew Greg is going to love that hooded sweatshirt. One of the great opportunities, Wes, you provided us was the ability to create the kind of program that mainstream radio and media just don't offer. We hope our listeners value conversations on healthcare, and do us a favor, call 860-685-7700 and support community radio.
I'm making my call right now. Hopefully all of our friends and listeners are out there making their calls.
If you're into celebrating birthdays, Westview's been around for 70 years.
And now we're going to hear our interview from Dr. Tom Bodenheimer.
As the Senate health reform bills move forward into debate, there are big questions that are beyond insurance coverage. Certainly, one of them is cost. Why are healthcare costs rising and what can be done about it? Beyond that, though, is the issue of care itself, and particularly primary care. Who will take care of us, and how do we want to be taken care of? What transformations and innovations are necessary to make primary health care more effective, more affordable, and not insignificantly, more satisfying, both for the providers and the patients who consume it? This week, Conversations on Healthcare takes a look at what some have called the crisis in primary care. And like all crises, there is hope and opportunity for a way forward. There are transformations and innovations already in place in a number of practices around the country that show the potential for solving some of our thorniest dilemmas in primary care. This week's guest, Dr. Thomas Bodenheimer, has spent 32 years in primary care practice as a general internist, 10 of those years in community health centers, 22 years in private practice. He's also the adjunct professor of family and community medicine at the University of California at San Francisco, where he co-directs the Center for Primary Care. His five-part series on the rising cost of healthcare, published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, are one of the most referenced works explaining the trajectory of healthcare costs in the United States and potential strategies to control them. So today we take a look at both the issues of rising healthcare costs and practice transformation. Conversations on Healthcare welcomes Dr. Tom Bodenheimer. Dr. Bodenheimer, thanks for being with us this morning.
Dr. Bodenheimer, you've talked about transforming primary care. What does that mean to the average consumer of healthcare? What should a thoughtful consumer expect to find in a world-class primary healthcare office or organization?
The first thing that I think a lot of people have trouble with their primary care practice or their primary care clinic is getting access. And when I say it, I don't mean financial access, which of course is a huge problem, but in terms of the practice itself, calling up on the phone and having your issues dealt with in a prompt way, being able to get an appointment the day that you need it, which often is today, being able to get the care you need nights and weekends without having to go to the emergency department. These access problems are major, major problems for the patients of primary care practices. So that would be, I'd say, number one. Number two is that after you've gotten the access, is that patients and doctors alike hate the 15-minute visit. The 15-minute visit is often just not sufficient to be able to deal with the problems that the patient wants to address. A lot of times there are, I think on average, there are like 3.5 diagnoses or problems in the average primary care visit, and 15 minutes is not enough time to deal with those problems. So I'd say those are two things that we have to deal with in terms of improving primary care.
So Dr. Bodenheimer, that would lead to the observation that across the country, we still find that most primary care physicians, I think about half, are in small practices, often one or two providers, oftentimes no nurses and not a lot of support staff. So how do those practices make those transformations to achieve the kind of practice that you talk about? And what support is out there for them to do it?
As you said, 46% of primary care physicians work in practices with one to two physicians only. Their practice team usually includes a front desk person and a medical assistant. The medical assistants do, take people's blood pressures and weigh them and maybe check their sugars and do electrocardiograms and draw blood. So there's not a lot of support for the doctor, and the doctor really has to do an enormous amount of the work. And usually these practices have patient panels around 2,500 patients, and it's just impossible for a doctor without more support to provide really good care for such a large panel of patients. So these small practices need to come together with one another somehow. And I don't mean they have to, join some huge polyclinic where there are, 200 doctors in one building. They could aggregate with other practices on a virtual level now that we have, they could have the same electronic medical record as other practices. They could share if you had, say, 10 practices, which each had two physicians, they could share, you know, a nurse, they could share a pharmacist, they could share people who could do some of the things that the physicians don't have time to do. But without the practices coming together in some way, I don't see how a very small practice can really solve all those problems.
You know, you've made the point that a small percentage of patients represents lots of the cost in healthcare, and we've actually have some good data on what makes the difference, coordinating care, managing the transition, the first 30 days after a patient leaves the hospital when a large number of patients get readmitted. How do you do this, and what are the models that have been shown to be effective, and why aren't we doing it everywhere?
There's some very good research that's been done that shows that both within primary care practices and in the transition from hospital to home, if you have a RN care manager, a nurse who is trained to manage complex patients, that nurse working with a relatively small panel of people, like it might be only 50, 60, 70 of these very, very sick, complicated people who utilize a lot of healthcare and incur, I would say, 70% of the cost in the United States. If you have a well-trained nurse care manager to work with those patients together with the physician, you can improve outcomes, improve care, improve patient satisfaction, improve quality of life, and reduce costs and reduce hospital readmissions significantly. The problem is hospitals don't have a financial incentive to reduce readmissions. They might get paid for a readmission. So why should they hire a nurse care manager with a relatively small caseload to do something that will hurt them financially? And primary care practices don't get paid for the work of that RN care manager, so they won't be able to afford it, and they have no financial incentive to do it. So you really have to. So the people who gain when you have these nurse care managers are the payers, the insurers. Generally, these patients are Medicare patients. So Medicare should really incentivize practices and hospitals to hire nurse care managers to be able to reduce the cost and improve the care of this small group of people who is so complicated and incurs mm-hmm. such a large percentage of our costs.
Dr. Bodenheimer, in healthcare circles at least, everybody seems to be talking about the patient-centered medical home. More healthcare jargon, or really a fundamentally different way of delivering care?
I think the people who promote the patient-centered medical home see it as a very, very different way of providing care. Number one, that patients would have access on the day that they need it. Number two, that the practice would really think about the care of their entire panel of patients. They'd have these electronic registries that all the patients, all their clinical data would be there, so you could really see which patients were not doing well, bring them in for care, which patients need preventive services that haven't had them, bring them in for care, be proactive, and really think about your whole population of patients, and have teams of people so that the doctors can try to get out of that 15-minute visit syndrome, have longer visits with people who really need it, and have other people perhaps care for people who just need very simple preventive care things, with the doctor overseeing the team, but the doctor not having to do everything him or herself. So the problem is these are very difficult things to accomplish without payment reform. You really have to pay for those aspects of the patient-centered medical home. So right now, pretty much practices get paid for either a doctor, a nurse, or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant visit, and that's all they get paid for. They don't get paid for all the things that need to be done in between the visit. They don't get paid for, say, doing a counseling, having a medical assistant do a counseling session on diet or exercise. They don't get paid for phone visits. Most places don't get paid for electronic, you know, communication with patients, which can really be very useful for both the patients and the practice. So all of the things that are part of patient-centered medical home that are new don't get paid for. So they're not going to happen unless they begin to get paid for.
Dr. Bodenheimer, you've asked if cost can be controlled while preserving quality. Your answer seems to be reflective in what we're seeing in the proposed health reform bill strategy, like disease management and care coordination to reduce use of hospital and emergency room departments by high-cost patients, strengthening primary care, and reducing medical errors. These are not simple and require both innovation and retraining. How do you see this happening?
Well, first, you know, it's true that you can improve quality and reduce costs at the same time, but it's very, very difficult. Number one, you have to have enough primary care physicians, because we know that with enough primary care physicians that have panels of patients that are not so large that the patients can't even get an appointment, if you have enough primary care physicians and those physicians are willing to see people or at least care for people nights and weekends, then you can really, I think, reduce emergency department visits, because I think 40% of emergency department visits are by people who just couldn't get access to their primary care and don't need to be in the emergency department. And once people get into the emergency department, it gets very expensive. A certain number of them probably get admitted to the hospital unnecessarily. All the things about readmissions, you really can reduce costs, but it's difficult to do, and I think people who think it's easy are going to fool themselves. And I think most people feel that most of the language in the healthcare reform bills in the House and the Senate don't really do very much to reduce costs. Probably to reduce costs, we're going to have to get rid of fee-for-service payment, because fee-for-service payment encourages more and more and more care to be done, whether it's needed or not.
Thanks, Dr. Bodenheimer. And, you know, in addition to being a primary care physician yourself, you're also an educator. And I know you're deeply engaged in training that next generation of primary care providers. How are you reaching these young medical students? And what are you saying to them about choosing a career in primary care?
Well, I work in the Department of Family Medicine, University of California in San Francisco. So we have family medicine residents that I work with, and also medical students who rotate through family medicine. I feel great hope. You know, I'm kind of pessimistic about where the healthcare system, but I'm very optimistic about some of the people who are going to be our future generation. They're really fantastic. They really want to serve people. They want to do new things. And I think just, number one, teaching them some of these new concepts, because generally what they learn is they learn the clinical work things that they need to learn, but they don't learn about how should I organize my practice? What, you know, how do I really make sure that people can be seen the day that they need care? What do I do about working with people, given all our new technologies with electronic medical records, with patient portals, emailing patients back and forth when a visit is not necessary? They need to learn all these new things because they don't see them in most practices.
Speaking of new things, Dr. Bodenheimer, you've obviously have a great eye for innovation. What are you seeing around the country that excites you, and who should we be watching?
There are some amazing things going on, but most people don't know about them. So in the community clinic world, again, I'm not familiar with maybe your community clinics or maybe your particular clinic that you're in right now is doing all of these things, but the clinic that I've seen that has done all of the things that you would want a practice to do is Clinica Campesina in Denver, Colorado. It's just an amazing, amazing clinic. I'm sure there are others like it, but it's one example. Then in terms of a non-safety net practice, Group Health in Seattle has a clinic that's sort of their pilot clinic for becoming the patient-centered medical home. It's called the Factoria Clinic. It's done incredible things. It's interesting, one of the first things it did was to reduce the panel size for its physicians and to increase the visit length from 15 minutes to 30 minutes. Physician satisfaction went up like 500%. Patient satisfaction went up. Quality outcomes improved. And they reduced their emergency department visits and hospitalizations and actually paid for all the innovations that they did within a year. So there are practices that are doing amazing things. But most of us don't know about them. There's not like a clear-cut sort of, I mean, if you go to the medical journals, you don't hear about these things because most of them are not studied. They're not, you know, they're not research studies. They're just improvement.
Well, we share that philosophy with you, and we believe we all ought to be contributing to the research. But Conversations on Healthcare is another way of helping to get the word out on those innovations and on what is working. And Dr. Bodenheimer, thank you so much for being with us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Margaret, Dr. Bodenheimer really pulled all the threads together on transforming the primary care office. And I think he has lots of physicians rethinking the way they're practicing medicine.
Well, he is really a respected and admired thought leader in the field, and his work and recommendations will make real some of the reforms that the country is looking for.
Speaking of things we're looking for, you to give us a call at 860-685-7700 or log on to WESUFM.org to make your donation to our annual pledge drive. Don't forget that we have some gifts for those of you who make that pledge. A $25 donation will get you a brand new WESU t-shirt. A $30 donation will give you a WESU long sleeve shirt. And a $50 donation will get you a WESU hooded sweatshirt.
That's great. And one of the great opportunities that WESU has provided us was the ability to create just the kind of program that mainstream radio and media don't offer. We hope our listeners value and enjoy Conversations on Healthcare. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Dr. Bodenheimer and the many other guests we've had on over the past few months. So do us a favor. Call 860-685-7700 and support community radio by making a donation or do it online at WESUFM.org.
Well, we have a couple of bright ideas today. One is to give a gift and make a pledge to WESU and call us at 860-685-7700 or log on to WESUFM.org. And now here's another bright idea. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week, Bright Ideas focuses on improving wellness and cutting healthcare costs in the workplace. According to the new Thomson Reuters report, the current U.S. medical system wastes about $7 billion a year. The source of much of this waste is the messy combination of unnecessary treatments and repetitive testing. While the healthcare reform bills currently pending in Congress contain provisions to combat these sources of waste, many employers have already taken matters into their own hands and are finding ways to reduce these costs through workplace wellness programs. One such company is Johnson & Johnson, which implemented a series of extensive workplace wellness programs in 1995. Company officials say that they and their employees have been reaping the benefits ever since. Johnson & Johnson provides its 100,000 employees with a wide variety of wellness programs, including free smoking cessation classes, online weight loss and stress management programs, and 30 on-site fitness centers. Other initiatives include Eat Complete, which provides employees with highly nutritional meal options at work, and Move and Make It Matter, which helps employees fit exercise into their busy schedules. Other companies have experienced similar benefits after creating comprehensive wellness programs for their employees. In fact, researchers for the Center for Disease Control and Prevention recently concluded within 2 to 5 years of implementing these programs, companies can yield $3 to $6 in savings for every dollar they invest. With U.S. healthcare spending to double in the next decade, cost-cutting wellness programs like these will become increasingly important. Cutting long-term cost and improving health in the workplace, now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.